WrestleSpective Radio is not affiliated with World Wrestling Entertainment, TNA Wrestling, Ring of Honor Wrestling, or any other sports entertainment entity or personality.
You're listening to WrestleSpective Radio. Learn to love it.
Greetings and welcome to WrestleSpective. I am Jason Mann. And before we begin, let me talk to you about our sponsor, RudoReels.com, which is a great source for DVDs and downloads of professional wrestling, whether it's in the United States, Japan, Mexico, or anywhere they professionally wrestle. So check out RudoReels.com. They're also on Twitter and on Facebook. And my guest today, he is the co-host of the International Object Podcast, Rich Thomas, first time here on the program. Rich, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you. And I've been a fan for a long time.
Well, I definitely appreciate that. And we are talking about a very, very interesting match, a match that Tom Holzerman wondered if we hated ourselves for watching it, which I'm not really sure where that comes from, because it's not a bad match by any stretch of the imagination. It is ECW One Night Stand, the main event of John Cena defending the WWE Championship against Rob Van Dam. And Rob Van Dam, of course, a man who would have pointed himself as he would have said Rob Van Dam.
He would have gone, Rob Van Dam.
Indeed. He would have done, and the crowd would have furiously chanted that with him. At least this crowd certainly did.
Oh, yes, definitely. They chanted it even when he tried to do other things, other chants, which
right.
I noticed during the night. But
yeah, they were a very chanty, loud crowd for sure.
Yes.
And so this is during the time in which WWE decided to revive ECW and create a third brand. They, of course, had Raw and they had SmackDown, which had been established for, you know, for a good 4 years by this point. They decided to, a year before, they'd had the One Night Stand pay-per-view in 2005, which had sort of been just basically a reunion. There weren't really a whole lot of storylines in that match. There weren't like matches that necessarily were built up to in the traditional manner. It was just like, come and see, you know, all, you just come and see some of the old ECW legends and some of our guys who used to be in ECW and kind of celebrate it. And there was some stuff with, you know, like JBL and Kurt Angle, I believe, being against it. But, you know, beyond that, it wasn't really like this type of show, which was much more of a traditional pro wrestling show headlined by this match, which had been built up traditionally on TV for weeks and weeks. It was kind of a more basic thing, but, you know, it was really there to set up this third brand of ECW.
Like, when I wonder, I always kind of wonder what came first. Did they get the time slot first and then try to revive it? Did they try to revive it and go out and find a time slot to put it on? Because if you go way back in WWE history, not that far, into the 80s, they would run three road teams a lot of the time.
Yeah.
That you'd have the Hogan team, the Savage team, and a third team, which either would be the tag titles, or sometimes it would just be who's ever fighting. I can't think of his name now. The guy from Memphis.
Honky Tonk Man?
Yes.
Yes.
And the third team, the C team, would be about who's ever beating up the Honky Tonk Man.
Sure. Yeah, and I believe they even had like fourth tier shows. Very rarely, but occasionally they would. I mean, they really like they had like four touring brands. So I know Ultimate Warrior, kind of his first year in WWE, they kept him really on the small shows to kind of develop him, so he would get, you know, sort of even decent from like 87 to 88 ish. So. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, the kind of the idea was they would go on the road and be their own brand and, you know, and obviously do small shows. But the look of the show was different from the other two shows. You know, they were kind of – they brought in some of the old ECW acts like Sandman and Sabu, Balls Mahoney, you know, guys like that. And they also kind of added Big Show and Kurt Angle, who was going to kind of be like revamped into the wrestling machine type character, but then he ended up bolting not long afterward. And the whole, basically the idea that ECW was going to have got, you know, shifted 20 times anyway. So, you know, that wasn't necessarily going to work anyway, but yeah, my understanding is that they came with the idea first and then found the time slot on Sci-Fi, which had never had wrestling before.
Yeah.
And that was kind of a new thing for them. They were, I guess that was sort of, it was sort of an uneasy fit because, I remember there being talk like ECW, they were going to try to like promote like, you know, science fiction or fantasy elements in the ECW thing, which, you know, they had like Kevin Thorne and Ariel the Vampires and a couple of like little things like that, but it didn't really, it wasn't anything more than that, really.
The Boogeyman.
Or, well, oh yeah, I guess, well, is the Boogeyman count? They had the Wolfman, I believe, like in the very first one, or no, the Zombie, that's what it was. Yeah. And they had Sandman beat up the Zombie, and that was sort of the joke yeah. they kind of were telling.
Yeah, I just remember that the Boogeyman was part of the ECW for
a long time. I mean, they threw in a lot of guys in ECW in like the years afterward, you know, but in the first, you know, 6 months or so, it was kind of still meant to be the, you know, the old ECW, you know, vibe.
ECW, Paul Heyman had in the original ECW, he had a formula, which was hardcore wrestling, technical wrestling, and high flyers. And since he was the guy who was trying to restart it, you saw those elements are what he tried to bring in with that kind of technical wrestling would have been represented by Kurt Angle. And the hardcore wrestling you saw, and he even brought in like Little Guido, of the FBI, and I forget if Super Crazy for that more high flying.
Right.
But that same formula, you could see those elements there, even though it did not really add up to the same effect.
Yeah, yeah. So the story here is that Rob Van Dam wins the Money in the Bank at WrestleMania, and becomes the first guy. Well, I guess this was only the second Money in the Bank, so it wasn't really that noteworthy, but he, being the good guy, decides, hey, I'm going to cash in my Money in the Bank the honorable way. Although he does pick a venue that is advantageous to him since he has the, you know, quote unquote, home court advantage here. But he, you know, instead of, like pretty much everyone else has of, taking advantage of a weakened opponent and instantly going forward, he actually picks time and a place, so he gives Cena at least a chance there. But, you know, RVD was sort of an interesting character because, you know, he was, you know, the last really top-tier guy to remain in ECW. I mean, you know, ECW had its survivors like Tommy Dreamer and, you know, that, and, you know, guys like that, but it, but most of those guys were guys that the major promotions didn't really want. I mean, Rob Van Dam was the last guy who was like definitely super duper type star who sort of, you know, for whatever reason, whether it was just opportunity or what, you know, or attitude or whatever, what have you, when ECW finally shut down, he had never been in the big two promotions. And of course, WCW shut down at the same time. So WWE was his only choice, and when he went there, he immediately was a breakout star.
Yeah, I would say in that whole invasion angle, he made out the best of anyone who was on the Alliance.
Oh, by far.
He was the person who kind of showed, I really thought that he showed that he had something to bring to WWE at the time that was unique and novel, and something that complimented some of their other talent.
Yeah, and you know, I'm not the biggest Rob Van Dam fan in the world by any means, but he is a unique character. I mean, there is no one like him in his wrestling style, and certainly even more so in his personality and just the dynamic he has with the crowd and his attitude and his look and all of that stuff is him, and it's very unique, and that's one of the reasons why he's, you know, thrived for this long, you know, because he just has that connection with fans through that character.
I find it really interesting that he was a face his whole time in the WWE.
Mm-hmm.
That whole run, and up until now, like as since he turned face in ECW. I don't think he's been a heel ever after that.
I mean, I think he was technically a heel in WWE for during the initial stages of the invasion angle, but fans never took to him as a heel.
No. And he definitely, during that, one of the failures of that angle was that there are so many fans of those other two brands that it didn't really, the line between who is a heel and who is a face is part of the problem there.
Yeah. So. Absolutely. Right. So he, you know, once the response was clear, he was, you know, pushed into some title feuds. He had, you know, I believe there was a three-way with him and Steve Austin and Kurt Angle in 01. And then, you know, kind of in, he was lost in the shuffle for a little bit there, but then in 02, when they did the brand split, he had that program with Triple H and then lost at the end of that. And then he sort of seemed to meander for a few years. And definitely, I think there's a significant effort difference in his matches from 01 and 02 through his ones in 03, 04, and 05, where he's, you know, just doesn't seem to have the same, you know, sharpness, the same crispness, the same, you know, effort in most of those matches. And it, you know, and he wasn't being pushed strongly, and it was sort of one of those things where, like, you know, he hit the supposedly hit the glass ceiling and then was just sort of settled into a spot. But here, you know, with this ECW revival, it clearly motivated him. I remember the year before he couldn't be at the – he was injured, so he couldn't wrestle the show, but he did one of the better promos of his career talking about, you know, how excited he was to see this back and how much – and it, this clearly meant a lot to him.
Yeah, I think it did, and – watching this match, like, I haven't had a chance to watch the matches around this, to watch other pay-per-views in this time or the Monday night matches, but really I thought I was impressed by his effort in this match.
Yeah, I mean, some bumps he takes in this match are just insane.
Yeah.
And but they work within the context of the match too. I mean, he doesn't do anything like super flashy or silly that, you know, makes it seem, you know, goofy. I mean, it's a pretty well-structured match, I would say.
Oh, yeah, I think so. One of the things, as we get into it, I really think the story of the match is really interesting, and the way they tell the story between the two wrestlers and the way the crowd is involved in ways that are both annoying and interesting.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So, you know, and another big thing during this time is the backlash against John Cena, which, of course, is, you know, the story of this match more than anything. He won the title at WrestleMania 21 in 2005 and was a pretty dominant champion for the rest of that year. Had a quick loss and regained it to Edge at the beginning of 06, cashing in the first Money in the Bank. Then, you know, and it was late in 05 where the fan reaction to him started to be split. And that was, you know, kind of a source of worry at first, but as it sort of kept happening and his fans got more fervent and the fans against him got more fervent, it ended up working in his favor.
I was trying to think back because I was watching at that time and I don't know, like, I don't remember the point where people started to turn on him. Like, I don't remember if there was anything that incited that or if it just kind of the way he was booked so strongly and the way he seemed to be invulnerable.
It was, I think, like October, like the summer to fall, the Jericho feud at SummerSlam when Jericho left. And there was some fans cheering for Jericho at that point. And then the Angle feud afterward, where Angle seemed to be kind of playing into the fans being into him even though he was the heel, and he was talking about how Cena couldn't wrestle. That was kind of when the first Cena can't wrestle talking point started. And then Triple H continued a lot in early 06 when his WrestleMania feud as well. So I think that's kind of was one of the catalysts where the you can't wrestle type thing, you know, was encouraged. Or I don't know if it was intentionally encouraged, but the fans obviously picked up on it. So, but yeah, so that obviously coalesced here where everyone in this crowd just – John Cena represents WWE, like this, you know, what they consider phony, what they consider artificial, what they consider corporate wrestling, you know, what you know, what basically killed their beloved ECW in a sense, even though it's reviving it here. That's a whole, you know, big contradiction. But, you know, he's sort of the, you know, he's the epitome of this new era of wrestling that most of them probably are not really excited about.
So the reason I picked this match is because I actually was, when I got out of college, is when I first saw ECW, and that was in the mid-90s. And a lot of the things in the world of the mid-90s would really, in wrestling, really had a kind of cartoon image. Like, Razor Ramon and Diesel and all those things in WWF at the time really had that kind of over-the-top image. And there's this level of John Cena, which you could see is going back to that. And while in the mid-90s you could turn other directions, the WWE is clearly into its era of monopoly here. And I think part of the idea that there's a bittersweetness in seeing ECW come back under that monopoly. Mm-hmm. And I really like the way that the fans are acting has something to do with that, at least in my mind, having been like an ECW fan way back when.
Right. So, yeah, it's obviously a mixed feeling because at the same time, yeah, they're bringing back this thing that, you know, they think is really cool and represented a pure form of wrestling, not necessarily pure in the technical sense, but pure in the catharsis, the emotion, the storytelling, the down and dirty, gritty, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And then, you know, you're bringing it back and you're bringing back some of the names and you've got Paul Heyman. I guess Paul Heyman's kind of the key because Paul Heyman's the figure that you can be like, okay, as long as Paul Heyman's vision is realized here, then this can be a thing that I like and will work and won't be ruined by, the WWE-izing it, so to speak.
Yeah.
It's a hard thing to say. that's kind of where we are. That's kind of how this is set up, the context that we're here. And Joey Styles and Taz are a commentary team, which, I'm not the biggest Joey Styles fan in the world. And it's kind of interesting how their reaction to, well, a couple of interesting things. One, they have, of course, are representing ECW here, but yet they are also representing WWE, and they have to kind of go out of their way to talk about John Cena's toughness and John Cena's resiliency. And even though these fans don't like John Cena, he's brave and bold for being here, that kind of thing. Which, of course, is not what the fans, you know, who are watching, most of them probably want to hear. But, you know, they obviously have to tread that fine line because John Cena is still their number one guy and, you know, and the most important wrestler in wrestling at the time and, you know, probably even today. And
well, I think the psychology of actually portraying him any other way would fail. Mm-hmm. Because you want to portray that RVD is making an accomplishment. So to have John Cena be anything but tough and a hard mountain to climb would diminish what Rob Van Dam's trying to do.
Right. That's a good point.
So if these guys just bagged on John Cena the whole time, not only would it not help their overall company, but it wouldn't help what they're trying to start here.
That's true. Yeah. That is a good point. But it's just that dichotomy from what they're saying to what the crowd is saying is sort of unusual. I mean, it's not like it's unprecedented, but it's sort of unusual for the commentary and the audience to be on such different pages.
Okay.
I guess it's kind of more what I'm thinking.
That makes total sense.
Yeah.
And there's always the sense, to me, there's a sense that they're not the voice of the fan in the building. They're more trying to be the voice of the fan that's watching the pay-per-view.
Sure, sure.
And that it is clear because the way they refer to the fans behind them as a real kind of like their own entity. Mm-hmm. So I really thought that, to me, when I listened to the commentary, that's what I thought.
Yeah.
But as you said, this is such the crowd noise is so loud on this DVD, on the match, you have to turn it down. And a couple times viewing it, I just had to turn it down below the point where I could hear any commentary. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah, I mean, it's obviously they're amped the entire time. I mean, it's loud. It's, you know, they're crazy for sure. And, it just, you know, there's the tension between them representing ECW's point of view and representing WWE's point of view, I guess, is because it's kind of two different things. And I totally get what you're saying, but at the same time, there's just some, not quite clumsiness, but there's definitely some, like, tension between the two points of view, I guess.
So I will say this. So I'm a Joey Styles fan.
Uh-huh.
And outside of Jim Ross, I don't think any of Joey Styles' contemporaries are any better.
Mm-hmm.
So he's at least as good as anyone who's contemporary. But Jim Ross is in that all-time category.
Sure.
So I'd like to point that out. But anyone else, just not, like, comparative. Like, there's no one else you can say, oh, if they had this guy do the announcing, it would have been better. And I really think that the problem Joey Styles had here is, you, even though he'd done this from time to time, I don't think he was full-time before this doing commentary.
Actually, no, I don't think that's true. I think he had come back before.
He had come back before, but he'd come and gone. Like, for a while, he was the SmackDown commentator.
Right. But, yeah, I know, because he did. I think part of this angle was that he quit Raw and then came back to ECW.
Oh, I think you might be right there.
Because I think there was one of Jim Ross had. You know, maybe when he had colon cancer, or was dealing with, you know, I don't remember exactly what it was, but I remember they did the colonoscopy thing that, you know, the fake colonoscopy thing that Vince did, which I think was 05 or I don't know, the timelines all kind of blur together, obviously, but
in that case, I would say that Joey Styles is not at his best.
Yeah, no, I don't think he's terrible. I just think, like, I think he could be insufferable on his own, and I think just that style was not my favorite. I mean, I will say that one nice thing about doing podcasts about Joey Styles, of matches that Joey Styles announced, is very easy to take notes, because he calls pretty much every move, or every move that, you know, of note that I may not know the name of, he calls it. So that's very helpful. And he certainly had a strength. I think the weaknesses, from my point of view, is that the dynamics, that he would play things up so big and he would get excited a lot. And I think that would sort of lessen the big moments, because he would play it big more often than I feel like, you know, he should have. And just kind of being, when he was doing it by himself a lot, I just kind of feel like just having that one voice, it got insufferable. I mean, I don't know if that's his fault, just because he's only one voice, and maybe that's just a personal style of commentary I don't care for, but that's just kind of how, you know, that's the perspective I'm coming from anyway.
I think in some of the ECW times, I really think it fit well, that because there's some of that ECW stuff so over the top that I think if someone was trying to call those things straight, I don't know, it's so over the top that I thought he injected a kind of joy into it. So, but I can definitely see what you're saying.
Yeah.
But I also think when you're talking about calling things, exaggerating, it's a problem with wrestling announcers in general.
Sure. Oh, yeah. I mean, that's Tony Schiavone, what he was notorious for, which is not, I don't know if it's entirely fair, but yeah, you know, every Nitro was the biggest Nitro ever, that kind of thing.
Yeah. So.
Yeah.
I can definitely agree. But.
Yeah. So we're in Hammerstein Ballroom. I don't know if that was mentioned, New York City, which was ECW stronghold. Not quite the ECW arena, but certainly a major venue for them. Continues to be a major venue for ROH and probably other independent groups. Also, of course, Monday Night Raw was, you know, the original Monday Night Raw shows in 93 were from Hammerstein Ballroom. So, you know, a lot of this is where your hardcores like to watch the wrestling. And Rob Van Dam, when he comes out, obviously gets a huge pop. Styles mentions he's 6 Intercontinental titles and the long running reign of the TV title that ended when he was only by injury, and that he was probably the greatest wrestler who had never won a world title, or you know, or greatest wrestler at that time anyway, who had never won a world title. Also that this is the first time the WWE title has been defended in an ECW ring.
Yeah. So I would like to say something about the crowd.
Sure.
It is clearly somewhere between 95 and 99% male.
Oh, like, yeah.
As wrestling audiences are usually not really diverse,
mm-hmm.
this is really, really just guys, mostly white New Yorkers, is what it looks like.
Yeah.
Like, and overwhelmingly.
And 20s and 30s.
Yes.
Maybe some late teens.
Yes, but very much a specific demographic has come out to see this.
Yes.
And it manifests itself all over the place. Like the famous "If Cena wins, we riot" sign.
Yes.
There's another sign there that makes me think that someone was having a little precognitive thing where they had the RVD 420 sign.
Ah, yes.
So, and I just sent a picture. I just tweeted out a picture of the sign. "I came to see Cena die."
I missed that one. I did see at the end there was the "champ is queer" sign, which is always a lovely one.
I took a couple of notes about that.
Yeah.
And I want to talk about that at the end of the show. But there's also, there is a little more than a little homophobia in the ECW crowd.
Perhaps a little bit. Perhaps there is a little bit of that. But Taz says that Rob Van Dam exemplifies everything ECW is, which is, you know, saying a lot. I mean, that's I don't know how you feel about that, because I feel like ECW was like so much more than what Rob Van Dam was. I don't know.
It is one of those things on its face with its comments, a throwaway comment, but it's a really kind of telling comment too. Like, there's certain levels of, like, yeah, ECW was a little bit about missed opportunities. And ECW was about maybe overachieving a little bit, mm-hmm. and underachieving all at the same time.
Yeah.
So Rob Van Dam, yeah, he might be the best analog. Either him or Tommy Dreamer are the best analog for ECW.
Mm-hmm.
So, or at least there's one of the main stories there.
Yeah, I mean, are they, you know, the most important figures in ECW history, or, you know, among them? Absolutely, yeah. It's just interesting. I just think of Rob Van Dam as, and I guess maybe ECW was, you know, both are, you know, both popular, both had their successes, both achieved, you know, more than you might expect, but both have their great flaws as well, at least to me. So, I guess maybe that fits, the more I think about it. There's a big pause between the entrances, which allows the crowd to get a few chants in. We get a few whole effing shows, although effing is the actual word. Chants. And then finally, Cena's music hits, as we expected, is hostile. I like what Cena does here for a couple things. He stands pretty much still coming out. Surveys the crowd, does his mini Marine salute like he normally does after, you know, a few seconds of holding that. There's a lot of smoke, right? You know, he's kind of coming through the smoke. I think it's really cool, and I don't think he regularly did this, or maybe he did, but he holds the title as he's walking through the entrance. And then the crowd is close enough that they can kind of touch him. Which is sort of unusual during this time. You see a lot of old shows, where that happens. But by this time, most of the shows that, you know, WWE would have, there's a good distance where you can't touch the wrestlers as they're coming through. It's just kind of a cool visual, and he has you can see a little bit of nerves. You can see a little bit of defiance. You can see a little bit of almost joy. There's a lot of emotions in his face as he's doing this. And he does a nice job of, you know, presenting the difficulty of his situation.
I appreciate it that there's no commentary on his walk to the ring. That the announcers let that moment happen. And I thought that that made it so much better.
Yeah.
Because, like, just let there be the natural sounds going on. And I really think that it's a great start, because his emotions are so much about what this match is about. And I notice that same kind of look of determination. So.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, this really is, looking back on it, it is so much John Cena's match.
Oh.
It really is. He's really the focus of it. And in the end, it really, you know, like, this is supposed to be like Rob Van Dam's moment, and it doesn't feel like that really at all. I mean, he's obviously there and it's ECW's thing, but it just feels like, yeah, that's just completely been overshadowed.
Yeah. And when I watched it, when I watched the pay-per-view originally, I didn't think that, but watching, getting the DVD and watching the match now, it is clear to me that this, the match is about John Cena more than it's about Rob Van Dam. And that, like, it's John Cena's story about going through this.
Yeah.
Which I really appreciate the way he performs in the match. Right. I do want to bring up this as they get into the ring. I had totally forgotten that he had had branded underwear. That the Chain Gang logo is on the band of his underwear.
I totally missed that.
I'd forgotten about the Chain Gang logo. But as I was watching this, and they're kind of, there is that level, like, this look is kind of at the beginning of his Marky Mark look. So, or somewhere in there.
Right.
With the way the underwear hangs and the jorts. But yeah, his, to me, it's one of those things where it's like, did they sell those? Was that merch you could buy? Or was that just someone stitching that together for him?
That is an excellent question that I cannot answer at the moment, but maybe
if anyone out there in Twitter land can answer.
Yes. Yeah.
Please do.
I a Google search does not immediately indicate anything. So we'll just have to see if anyone else can help us out on the Twitter or however they want to contact us. So we have a big to-do with John Cena tossing his shirt into the crowd and the crowd throwing it back at him. And this happens, you know, probably four or five times before Cena just gives it up and drops the shirt onto the floor. And it's a really nice bit of crowd interaction, you know, because the crowd's even amped about throwing it back and laughing at this. And, you know, and he's giving that the little bit of frustration and the little bit of, you know, tension, I guess, so to speak. It's real nice to the way that all plays out.
I really liked it because at first it seemed to me that he wasn't ready for that to happen. But as he played along with it, he really played into it.
Yeah.
And that was, I don't know if they thought that would happen or not, but if not, that was a great part of improvisation and realizing what's going on.
Yeah. Either way, it's great. I assume. Yeah. I mean, he does seem a little genuinely surprised at first, but that just could be just the character work too. It's really hard to tell, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously they were expecting a hostile crowd, so that can't have been a huge surprise, but you know.
Yeah. But it's one of those things that, so when he throws it, it almost looks like muscle memory. Mm-hmm. Like he does. So he does a little thing where there's all these little things he does as a wrestler that he does every time he gets in the ring.
Right.
And at this time, he was doing the shadow boxing and all of those things. So as the announcements go, he throws it, and it really looks like automatic until it gets thrown back at him.
And we have some loud ECW chants at this point. RVD, as he is wont to do, points to himself, and the fans chant Rob Van Dam. Then we get some toilet paper thrown at Cena, which does seem to get under his skin a little bit.
Yeah.
Again, whether that's, you know, that's a natural reaction or if that's just him playing into it or both, you know, is up for speculation. Cena eventually tears the toilet paper as we have F you Cena chance. They do a long lockup. RVD,
so
go ahead.
We get our first homophobic chant during the lockup.
Okay.
Did you notice that one?
I couldn't make that chant out.
Well, they were playing off they were playing off, I believe, the, oh no, they're calling him something. I don't want to use the term myself, to be honest.
Okay. Well, obviously, that's fine. That one I couldn't make out. That one I didn't mark because I couldn't make that one out. But as the long lockup is happening, they end up in the corner with Rob Van Dam's back to the turnbuckle. Cena doesn't really break; he just punches him instead. We get a you can't wrestle chant right as Cena does a cradle suplex. And then he grabs a headlock, gets tossed in the rope, knocks him down with a shoulder block. Van Dam misses an enziguri, but hits his first offensive move with a kick as he's sort of spinning around. Cena bails. There's a big pop and a whole effing show chance.
So I really thought that that was a bad spot in the match.
Uh-huh.
I thought that the match was starting to flow. And that seemed to stall the energy, like the whole Rob Van Dam's kick and then the bail. And I always I wonder if they knew that they were doing that to kind of cool down the pace a little bit. But it seemed like that the pace was starting to ramp up, and it's like, okay, let's stall it here a moment.
Yeah. My thought was that it was just the idea of Cena feeling frustration and kind of playing the very subtle heel. Yeah. Of Van Dam showing his superiority at least at that moment, and of Cena showing that the crowd's kind of getting into him a little bit, and that you know, and that he's no more Mr. Nice Guy, which is followed up with them sort of nose to nose in the ring, talking trash, and then they trade punches, and we get a booyah, dueling chant kind of thing. Some of the chanting here. Some of it feels like the crowd really wanting to get in Cena's head and wanting to kind of be an active participant that way. And some of it feels like the standard, like, we chant these things because this is what you do at an indie show. Or, you know, this is by all intents and purposes a indie-style crowd. You know, probably not too different from what an ROH crowd would have been at that time.
Yeah. I can definitely see that, and I really thought it's that times that some of the chants were just kind of dumb, and other the chants actually were. I thought the "Yay Boo" chant was actually pretty cool here.
Okay.
Myself.
Yeah. But, maybe I'm just not a big fan of that one for whatever reason. It just sort of like, I don't know. It's almost like a little bit too much. It's almost a little too meta for me, so to speak.
So I thought about one of the things that one of your claims is that. Rob Van Dam doesn't have good punches.
Yes.
And there's so many quick edits in the punch sequence that you have a hard time seeing the punches land. Almost all the punches from Rob Van Dam there, you're seeing from Cena's side and not from the Impact side.
Right.
And I thought that was... I was looking for that, having listened to your previous podcasts.
Yeah, and if you look toward after RVD wins that... They go to the ropes and RVD throws a couple of punches there and they're really bad.
Yeah.
The other ones, yeah, you're right. They don't look that bad, or maybe just the camera tricks hiding them. But yeah, it's a thing to me. It's like, I don't mind if your punches suck, but if they suck, don't do them, you know, do other things, you know, it's like one of those frustrating things. I don't know. Eventually Cena is able to get a power slam for two. Then he clotheslines Van Dam out of the ring. We get a same old shit chant from the crowd. And then Cena, almost in response to that, he comes off the top turnbuckle and does sort of a Macho Man style axe handle to Rob Van Dam's back as he's on the railing.
I thought that was a great move. That was like one of those, like, you just don't see that out of John Cena very often.
Right, which, I mean, even Taz and Styles, you know, go crazy for that he did that, you know. It was cool. The crowd not so impressed by it. Although they sort of, I don't know if they go quiet, but they definitely aren't like antagonistic for at least 30 seconds after he does that. So, They do some brawling outside the ring for a little bit. Cena slams RVD's head on the table and then grabs the title and holds it up. So you kind of see from this point of him doing a few things that definitely are actively, you know, antagonizing the crowd, so to speak.
Yeah. And I think that's great. And I think it made me miss heel John Cena. Because there's a certain point where his heel personality really comes out in this match. Mm-hmm. There's certain things he does, and it really some of his moves actually work, I think, extremely well as a heel, and it kind of makes me miss that.
Yeah, yeah. RVD is able to hop off the steps and do a moonsault on Cena, moonsault press, I believe it's called by Styles. Then RVD tries to go after a chair, but then Cena cuts him off and throws him into the rail. RVD hops onto the rail instead of being thrown into it, but then Cena pushes him into the crowd, basically into the third row, which was a pretty cool move. I think I've seen Van Damme do that before, but that was really well done the way they did that. So they go into the crowd, and then Cena grabs a FU Cena sign and shoves it into RVD's face, sort of, and that's definitely one of those heel moments that you know, he does.
I really wanted to see him punch him through the sign instead of pulling the sign out of the way like he's stapling it to it, but
yeah.
Oh well.
You can't have everything.
No.
So we a little bit later, Cena climbs onto the rail, and then RVD sort of kicks it, forcing him to stumble. Then RVD hits a corkscrew leg drop off the apron and hits a dangling Cena. Cena recovers a bit, slowly gets into the ring. RVD hits a baseball slide and then follows it with a guillotine leg drop onto the apron. Then RVD gets the chair and drop kicks it into Cena's face while he's sitting into the corner.
So the one thing you notice really here is you notice how much they're talking to the referee. That in regular WWE matches, there's not this much checking with referees, it seems.
Mm-hmm.
That it's not just like the referee. Maybe it's I don't like the referee selling, because it's not like checking to see if they're okay, but it really looks like passing instructions.
Hmm.
There's other thing about the chair. I remember before Rob Van Dam got into the WWE, one of the complaints that some wrestling writers had about him is he had too much chair-based offense.
Right.
That there's at one time where all of his signature moves were a move with a chair involved.
Right.
And he gotten away from that as in the WWE. But this just reminded me of that.
Yeah.
As he holds the chair up. Like, ooh, okay, we're going to get a Van Terminator. Or I always get those moves confused.
Yeah. Now, okay, is the Van Terminator does he have to come off the top to do the Van Terminator? Or
I really think that the Van Terminator is the baseball slide into the corner. I thought that was the Van Terminator.
Okay, I thought the Van Terminator was what Shane McMahon did at WrestleMania WrestleMania 17, where it came off the ropes and then went all the way to the other side, and then hit, you know, hit Vince with it. This is sort of a lesser Van Terminator because he's not coming off the ropes, but it's essentially the same idea. Yeah. And the Van Daminator is when he throws the chair into the other guy, the guy catches it, and then he hits the, you know, spin kick.
Yes.
Which he doesn't he doesn't do in this match.
No, he doesn't. And it's one of those moves I always thought was funny because, like, you could not catch the chair.
Right, exactly.
You get the chair to the head, which some guys did.
Yeah.
Or if you caught the chair and thought, like, oh, I got him, and then he kicks it.
Yeah.
So, and when he was a heel, I always found that a frustrating move because, like, why? Just move out of the way of the chair.
Yes, well, you know. Yeah, that's, again, one of those RVD has the tendency to have a lot of his moves strain credibility, or they're convoluted to the point where, like, you know, it's just hard to, you know, you can take it once in a while, but when he's doing a lot of those moves in every match, it sort of strains, you know, believability. So, speaking of chair offense, RVD is a rolling thunder with Cena holding the chair, which wasn't really smart on RVD's part because it just hurts his back.
So I have to say, like, to me, I know this is one of the critical things people are about his offense is that he hurts himself in his offense. I've heard that complaint, but I've always liked that. I've always liked that he's willing to invest in loss, that he's willing to sacrifice himself to do more damage to his opponent.
Okay.
And I know that, like, some people would say, well, it's a fight. You'd never want to do damage. But there's actually, like, theories of, like, warfare where you're willing to take damage if you can do more damage to the opponent. And so, like, him doing these moves where he hits the chair and hurts himself, like, or frog splashes and hurts himself but hurts the opponent more, to me, I always thought was a nice touch and was one of those things that you should see more of in wrestling and not less.
Yeah, I don't have a problem with sacrificial moves if they hurt your opponent more. I just kind of find that a lot of them didn't seem – they weren't sold that way,
yeah.
Maybe that's more the problem.
Yeah, well, I guess it's – Rob Van Dam sold it that way, but the announcers didn't.
Right, right.
At least that's
– yeah.
I saw it.
So Van Dam is slow to cover. Gets only two. Then he goes for the split-legged moonsault with a but Cena raises the chair up, and then RVD hits it, and then it hurts him. It doesn't hurt Cena.
Yeah.
Then Cena does the DDT onto the chair, and RVD does his dramatic DDT bump, which is a great bump. There's no question about that. Probably the best guy to take a DDT that I can think of, you know, at least just dramatically. I mean, maybe it's even a little overdoing it, but it's still pretty good. And then we follow that up with, we have a you can't wrestle chant again. Then Cena props the chair in between the turnbuckles and then sends RVD's face right through it, which is pretty, like, crazy.
I have to say, like, that, the sound of that move, however he hit that chair, just sounded horrendous to me. Like,
right.
It sounded like it made me go, oh, my God.
Yeah.
So that was one of those moments to me where it was really, like, I wonder if how much damage he actually did to himself with that bump.
Yeah,
into the chair.
Right, and you know who knows, but you know, yeah, that was definitely like, wow, that was a pretty incredible looking thing that he did there. Gets two. Cena hits the sit out proto bomb, one of his five moves of doom, which the crowd you know recognizes and boos. Then he sort of gets cocky with the five knuckle shuffle. He does it slow. He surveys the crowd. He sort of gestures a bit. Then he lands it and he plays to the crowd even more. He does a salute, which is great. And then he's clearly smiling as he gets an asshole chant. He waits for RVD to get up. Tries the FU, but then RVD is able to get out of it and get a spinning heel kick to counter.
So this is on this point where the five knuckle shuffle is a heel move.
Right.
And that he still does it and it's never left his repertoire is amazing to me.
Yeah.
That, like, this is anything but disrespecting your opponent to me is just an amazing idea. Mm-hmm. And, like, I guess, like, even if you're a good guy, you might disrespect your opponent. But that, to me, when I saw that, I'm like, and the way he smiles doing it this way, he's definitely in heel mode at this point.
Right, right.
And the other thing is, so he flashes his chain gang sign.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm trying to figure out when did he stop flashing that with the thumb and the pinkies out.
I don't know. Maybe that was a PG. Maybe that was like a gang sign type thing. They wanted to get away from that. That'd be my guess, but I don't have any memory of it.
Yeah, it's one of those things that, like, oh, yeah, he used to do that all the time. I totally forgot about that.
Yeah. Listeners, if you know, let us know. Cena attempts to charge but hits an RVD boot. He's able to lift RVD off of the top and sort of hit like a modified rock bottom. And RVD's head bounces off the canvas pretty hard off that one, too.
You know, that when I took that down, I called that a one-armed powerbomb.
Okay.
Is what that looked like to me.
Right.
that to me, yeah, I'm just like, why don't more people do that move?
Yeah.
I guess you need someone on the top rope like that, like trying to get up the top rope like that to execute it.
Yeah.
But I thought that that was a beautiful move that you just don't see.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it fit very well, you know, I mean, just perfect opportunity for him to do it. And it wasn't convoluted at all, which is, yeah, that's an obvious, it's like, oh yeah, obviously you would do that. That makes total sense.
Yeah.
And I mean, kind of a weird thing where RVD lifts Cena up and he's sort of like, it's look like he's trying to crotch him on the ropes, but like Cena won't land or he can't lift him up enough or whatever. And eventually Cena just sort of like tumbles over and falls to the floor.
Yeah, like, I wondered what that was all about. Like, where that miscommunication was, or it's like, did Rob Van Dam want to try something and John Cena go, no, you're not doing that.
Or just if yeah. Van Dam wasn't strong enough to lift him like he wanted to, or, I, you know, that's, yeah, I don't know about that one. But any other match, Van Dam would have been booed for that. But this crowd is not going to boo him for anything, you know.
I actually, in the retrospect watching this again, I love that spot because that's one of those spots that makes things look less staged.
Mm-hmm.
When you have that kind of mistake of no consequence.
Right, yeah.
Like, as long as no one's getting hurt when you do those spots, I think it's actually a pretty good idea to have some of those in matches.
Yeah. And Cena falls to the floor. Then he gets on the apron and RVD hits a drop kick and Cena lands on the railing. Maybe that's what he was trying to do, set him up on the apron and then hit the drop kick there. And then they sort of, you know, modified that. I don't know. But he sort of limps a bit for at least for a minute. I don't know if that quite lasts, but he might just shake that off. RVD gets a table, props it up against the corner. We get a whole effing show chant. I will say one thing I really liked about this match is that none of the table or weapon stuff took forever to set up. Like, they grabbed the weapon, they brought it in, they used it, they either got it out of the way or you know, it wasn't like anything where, like, they – it felt like they had to spend, like, 10 minutes setting up a table, which is stuff – which is when they would do it in ECW or in WWE or wherever. You just hated that stuff.
Yeah, I agree. That goes all the way back to me. All the way back to the Public Enemy. How long they would take to set up tables would be just forever.
Right.
But that's one of those things where it seemed like the offense was more, the offense with the tables was more, or with the weapons was more, it wasn't so intricate, so it worked.
Right. Yeah. It was more just like moment of opportunity where we're going to grab, okay, like I want a good weapon here. Here's a chair. Here's a ladder or whatever, you know? Yeah. So, however, he does take enough time in which Cena is able to get an STF out of nowhere. And you have Styles and Taz both actively pleading with Rob not to tap. Styles yells, "Don't tap, Rob, don't do it." And he finally is able to reach the ropes after probably a minute or so in the hold. And then the referee who had to look up is John Finnegan. Pulls.
Is it sad that I knew that it was John Finnegan?
I don't know if it's sad, not necessarily. No, you're a knowledgeable man. You know, I knew I recognized him. I just couldn't remember his name. He pulls Cena off after he doesn't break, and he's under no obligation to break because this is a no DQ match, I guess. So
it's a hardcore rules match. So. Right. Who knows what the hardcore rules actually are.
Right.
And I was just thinking about that. Yeah, I was thinking the same thing about the break, about Tajiri and how he used to do the octopus or the tarantula, whichever that was, in WWE. He would have to break in WWE, but he could win matches with it in ECW.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's different leagues, different rules, you know? It's like the National League, the American League, you know?
But making him break sets up the ref bump.
Yes, well, exactly. Yeah, basically, Cena is just like, they shove each other a little bit, and Cena's like, I'm just going to close on you down, you know, you fool, you know. So he lands him on a clothesline. Then RVD goes to the top, and Cena crotches him. He hits the superplex. He goes to the floor, grabs the steps, brings them in, slams RVD in the head, and then takes them and basically just drops them over the ropes onto the floor. Makes a pretty loud thud. Nick Patrick slides in after another few seconds, but the count is only two. And you see Cena, you know, questioning it, look of disbelief on his face, and, you know, two fingers up, like, you know, he tries the FU. Van Damme grabs the rope, so Cena, in a pretty dick move, just decides, you know, I'm just going to dump you over the ropes and land you on the floor, which is just a great, you know, like, yeah, that's awesome. That's good. So then a man dressed in all black with a motorcycle helmet comes in. He spears Cena and knocks out Nick Patrick. For what reason he knocks out Nick Patrick is not entirely clear. There's not really any purpose to that, but whatever. And it's Edge.
Yeah. I don't get why he had to wear the helmet.
Yes.
And then reveal that he was Edge right away.
Right. That doesn't make any sense at all.
Yeah. Like, if he would have gone backstage and revealed who was Edge, that would have made. Or if he would have just come out as Edge.
Right. But, yeah, the whole thing with motorcycle, it just seems like it adds, like, another element that it just didn't need. With the mystery of it.
Yes.
He mocks Cena with doing the "you can't see me" bit. And the crowd, which I will admit this is an inspired chant, chants "thank you, Edge."
Yeah.
For that. So Joey Styles at this point is, you know, it's like, okay, Edge, you know, don't be proud. We'll take this. Van Damme comes off the top rope with a frog splash. He tries to pull Nick Patrick in and revive him, but then Paul Heyman runs in instead and then counts the pin for three.
Yeah.
And we get a nice visual of Van Damme on his knees, being handed the belt, you know, sort of just, you know, like in reverence to the crowd and soaking the moment in. And then Heyman hands him the belt. And then this is, you know, the Van Damme finally realizing his dream and ECW getting its moments in the sun.
Yeah. So I want to say something about the Edge spear.
Yes.
They later show it in slow motion on the DVD.
Right.
Edge takes all of the bump of the spear.
Yes.
He totally, John Cena doesn't even, like, barely even touches the table.
Right.
Edge is like, oh, I'll just break the table then. It was like, oh yeah, that's why you never show slow motion replays in wrestling.
Yes.
Because I missed that the first time.
Right. Yeah, and the angle also, because, like, you saw it from the wrong angle, well, or the right angle, I guess, in the first time, because you couldn't tell that, and you know. Yeah. I will say that I feel like the Edge interference here doesn't really have a purpose either. I mean, yes, he's in the midst of a feud with Cena, and you can kind of get, okay, he wants to screw over Cena and cause him pain. I guess I get that. But he's no friend of Van Damme either. So it's sort of like, it really I feel like it, at least to a degree, if not a significant degree, undercuts Van Damme's moment here, and also, and for a purpose that doesn't make much sense in the story.
Yeah. I really think that it's one of these things. I really think I agree that it undercuts the story. I don't like it in retrospect at all, but maybe if this story after the pay-per-view, the story kind of gets cut short. So if he was actually going to face Edge at that future pay-per-view, or if the Edge was going to kind of do a storyline where he said, well, I got you the title and I'd rather face you than Cena, kind of playing that storyline, that could have worked.
Okay.
But I don't think that, from what they showed, I don't think they had any intention of going there.
No, that was kind of my guess as well. This was my thought. I mean, it comes off as, we don't want Cena to lose cleanly, so here's what we're going to do to make it so that he doesn't lose cleanly.
The same thing seemed true to me.
Right. And yeah, I mean, if there were a reason for the Edge interference that worked for the story, then I'm more okay with it. But it's just sort of, you know, it's just a lazy way to get a little, to in theory, get a little bit of heat on Edge and protect not for this crowd necessarily, but for a WWE fan perspective, and also, you know, and to protect Cena, so to speak.
Yeah. I do like after the match when he's going all throughout the arena. He goes up to kiss his wife, and then Rob Van Dam goes all over the arena, and you see all the people. And that's where you get one of the more infamous signs of the night, too.
Yes, yes. The champ is queer. That's a lovely one. That's the one. Yeah, yeah. So that's a lovely sentiment. Yeah. Classy crowd. Well, and I don't. That's not fair because I'm sure there are many, many classy people in this crowd who do not agree with that, those sentiments at all. But yeah, classy dudes in that crowd.
Yes, and he was so angry looking that he really wanted to insist that his sign got on TV.
Right.
The guy holding that sign.
Yeah.
But, it's, I really like the match up until the point where the stranger comes in and it turns out to be Edge.
Yeah, and it sort of feels like anticlimactic too, because he just hits the frog splash and that's pretty much, you know, that's pretty much it. Like I remember I'd seen the match before and I remember feeling that moment seemed more dramatic the first time, but it really just kind of felt like, that's it. You know, it didn't feel as like epic and big and as like cathartic as it should have to me. And I felt like, you know, the crowd is certainly cheering and happy and, you know, but I feel like Taz and Styles are really trying to sell the emotion of the moment and that real, you know, these ECW guys, you know, kind of doing something successful on this big stage. And I feel like it doesn't quite match what the crowd seems to be feeling.
Yeah. Yeah, I can see that. There was a real sense, like when I watch it live, that I had just had no idea how they were going to beat John Cena because of the way he had been booked up to that time.
Right.
So, and it was hard to believe that they were going to take the WWE title off John Cena. So at the time, the stranger felt less like this kind of like a bad booking decision and more out of nowhere. So.
Yeah. Yeah. I get that. There's the cool celebration in the ring. You have Big Show and Angle and Sandman and Dreamer and Just Incredible and Balls Mahoney and some others in there, you know, all celebrating in the ring. And Van Damme, after he celebrates with his wife and in the crowd, he comes back in. And, you know, and that's cool. And it's, you know, I mean, this is definitely a match I think people should watch. I mean, I'm not saying it's a great match, and but – you know, the weaknesses of both guys are largely hidden here. I feel like, you know, they pretty much limit their stuff, their offense that looks weak here, and their, you know, their flaws. And it, you know, it's pretty cohesive. Maybe that referee communication helped just, you know, kind of keeping them on track or whatever. But
I will also say, yeah, it seems well edited. It seems like some of the Rob Van Dam's problem in some of his matches is he doesn't edit himself well.
Right. Like, which is kind of a larger ECW problem to a certain extent as well.
Yeah. Someone will tell you go out and do X amount of time and you end up going doing a bunch of different things in that time. So yeah, I definitely could see that.
Right.
But yeah, I actually think they have a lot of chemistry facing each other.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I had no issues with the match as far, you know, how it went, you know, as far as just, you know, what they did and the moves and stuff, and the selling was pretty good, and, you know, and Van Damme bumped like a champ, and the interactions were great. I mean, they really, you know, brought everything out. I mean, and it's fun and it's enjoyable, and it's sort of a, you know, a promise of what maybe could have happened and didn't happen. You know, what ECW could have turned into and instead turned into.
Yeah, I don't think so. Like it's, to me, it's exactly, it's a kind of like, it's almost like an alternate universe. Like this night is an alternate reality.
Okay.
As was the one night stand in 2005.
Yeah.
And I don't like when I try to think about like the theories that would have got here, it's really hard to kind of to try to understand them. Like, even if everything that went wrong in ECW didn't. I don't know. I guess I just see that those things were inevitable.
Okay. As far as just ECW's problems, they're, you know, you mean like their 01, you know, or you mean the 06, 07, what ECW evolved into, or both?
Both.
Okay.
I think that market realities in 01 really kind of got ECW, the clock ran out.
Yeah.
On ECW in 01. It had a lot to do with the way the things, it's kind of, ECW's is best viewed as a startup that ran out of runway because they were spending more than they were making and they were investing in growth, but it ended up not being the market that they thought was there wasn't there.
Right. I definitely agree with that. I do think that because not only, what was it? It was two weeks later, I think. It was I believe July 2nd, where Rob Van Dam and Sabu were arrested with marijuana in the car.
Yeah.
And then Van Dam was the WWE champion. Obviously, he also was ECW champion, which they basically just gave to him, which was also kind of random. That's like, oh, you're an ECW champion too. Here's the belt. Okay.
I don't think that that's random at all. And I've actually thought that that was a pretty good booking decision to say, you know, saying you won this other title and then we're going to award you with this title to start.
Okay.
I think that there's no problem doing that because he's the champion of the company. And like, to me, to say that you have to have a tournament or you have to do it some other way is kind of a little nitpicky to me. I thought that
it was just like, it wasn't so much that they gave it to him without him earning it. That's not really what it was. It was just like they had a segment. They're like, oh, yeah, here's the ECW champ title. You're ECW champion. That, like, I don't remember any build to it. Like, it wasn't like, oh, we're going to announce the ECW champion or, oh, it's a big deal. We're going to crown our own champion kind of thing. It was like there was nothing leading to it. It was just like, okay, well, you're now ECW champion too. That was more kind of what I mean. I mean, it would have been kind of cool if they had like a match and he'd unified them or whatever. I mean, that's not the end of the world, but I just kind of felt like it just sort of was like, oh, this is an afterthought, and here's what we're adding to it. Which I assume the plan was to have him lose the WWE title, but keep the ECW title for a long period of time.
Yeah,
and that didn't happen. I mean, he lost the WWE title to Edge. And I think in a three-way with Cena, and they lost the ECW title the next night against Big Show. I think Heyman turned on him.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then he was kind of basically pushed in the mid-level area for the rest of his time in WWE, which is like another year and a half, I believe. Yeah. So I don't know. I think ECW may have been kept alive or may have been kept like as because for a while it was kind of it was almost ahead of SmackDown and what they were doing. I mean, it was sort of like, you know, like a storyline type show where, like, you know, big things are happening and important matches are happening, and they would bring in like guest stars, like, you know, when Big Show was champion, they would bring in like, he had an infamous match with Batista where the crowd just booed it to hell. But he had better ones, like I think he and Flair had a hardcore match, and they brought in Undertaker. They would just kind of have like, you know, oh, you know, this week we're going to have SmackDowns, blah, blah, blah. And they were kind of doing their own stories and kind of, you know, making it at least a somewhat important show for a while. And I think it may have stayed that way a bit longer if that hadn't happened with RVD, but it probably doesn't change the calculation long term, just maybe a few months or what have you.
Yeah, I guess I see. There was something that Alex Greenfield said when he was on MLW radio, that he, when he was put as the head writer of SmackDown, he wrote a script that basically would have changed the visual look of SmackDown and would have changed it, made it distinct from Raw.
Right.
And he basically got shut down from that. And I think that's the decision that makes ECW not work. like not being SmackDown not being distinct from Raw ends up leading to the things that happened, that ECW is just a sub brand of SmackDown.
Right.
Like all of those dominoes are in a row. Like they did not tour as its own show very long. Like the ECW end up being folded into the SmackDown tour and taped at the beginning of SmackDown shows rather early in the process.
Right.
And at that point, the kind of idea that this is something novel and different really falls apart. Mm-hmm. And it really became just the place where new guys might wrestle.
Right.
It really became the kind of WWE minor league at that point.
Which, right. You know, it has moments doing that, but it obviously having the ECW name and becoming that is something that, you know, certainly could have been used better.
Yeah, and I thought, like, they had some really good storylines, and I even really liked the ECW Originals versus the New Breed storyline. Or do they call them the New Breed, or they call them something else?
I think they did call them the New Breed.
I thought that storyline actually was done quite well.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a great kind of struggle between the kind of values and youth risk experience and those things.
Right.
So, but yeah, in the end, I think ECW was doomed once it was just a minor league show.
Right.
Yeah. And I think that NXT turned out to be a little better, but still doomed. But that's the ECW went off the air when NXT started, correct?
Yes. That was in 2010. So yeah, ECW lasted 4 years, I guess.
A lot longer than I would have expected, or I can remember. But then again, I can't remember at what point I gave up on it.
Yeah, I gave up on it probably sometime in a few months after it, you know, after the novelty kind of wore off. And honestly, I mean, ECW was something where probably the novelty was going to wear off unless you really could create something new and exciting out of the old that still captured the spirit of the old. That's really hard to do.
It is hard. And I think I really thought when CM Punk debuted on ECW, there was that thought that you could create this different style of wrestling.
Mm-hmm.
You could have this different style. But a lot of that, I think bringing in the guest stars and bringing people from other brands hurt ECW a lot.
Yeah.
Because instead of it being distinct, it was just another thing. And right. I think there's a general, I think that WWE had this real problem with, has a real problem with return on investment on TV, mm-hmm. where their most important commodity is TV time. So they end up making the TV look a lot the same because that's what sells. Instead of having one TV that sells less than the other, well, why don't we get the most out of our investment?
Mm-hmm.
And it ends up watering down the product in the long term.
Right.
And I think that is really what happened with ECW, is they got so watered down because it just was SmackDown Light.
Yeah. It was basically Tuesday Night Heat.
Yes.
Yeah.
Ooh. Tuesday Night Heat.
Right. So, yeah. So, but, you know, it's... For the one night moment in time, it's fun. You know, there's a decent number of these matches where it's just sort of like, yeah, you know, the follow up wasn't the best, and but we got this, and this was kind of cool. And you know, if you're, you know, particularly an RVD fan or an ECW fan, certainly a moment I would guess most fans, you know, have a little bit of, you know, a nice thing anyway.
And yeah, I thought this as a standalone event is pretty nice. As a start of something bigger, it just couldn't fulfill those needs.
Yeah.
I don't think any pay-per-view could though.
No, it's a challenge. But yeah, I mean, you know, the one-night stand shows, the ECW versions of them are really fun shows, particularly the first one. That's a really just that atmosphere and just the way that show kind of came about. It's really, really quite entertaining. This one's good too. And it has the really good, the six man with Foley and Dreamer and, Edge and Terry Funk.
I still don't understand why they had to have that be an intergender match with the women involved.
They changed it to the last minute too. Yeah. That was weird, but it's a great match.
It is a pretty good match. It's enjoyable and it's fun, and you get a lot of, you get a, Mick Foley cutting this kind of anti-ECW promos, which are always fun.
Yeah.
And he wrestles as Mick Foley. And I don't know how many other matches he wrestles as Mick Foley. Not announced as Cactus Jack or one of his other personas.
Yeah, not that many. I mean, he did it at WrestleMania 2000. I think he's got a handful now. But yeah, it certainly is pretty rare. I loved his stuff then. And was it that summer that he had the feud with Flair too? Or was it the next summer? I can't remember off the top of my head.
I don't know if he had a Flair. Yeah. I can't even say those three words together. I don't know if he feuded with Flair that summer or not. And I know that that was the WrestleMania that Edge beat him.
Yes. Yeah.
So that's what led into that.
Mm-hmm.
But,
yes, it was that SummerSlam. So that summer was the last time Foley, at least for WWE, really had, you know, some major stuff. And that was a really fun period. That was one of the top things that I really enjoyed, was, you know, yeah, Foley stuff in ECW and then the Flair feud, you know, the good times. I'm a big Foley fan, so.
I'm a big Foley fan, and my hope is to never see him take a bump ever again.
Yes, I agree with that. Absolutely.
And I feel that the WWE should give him a paycheck every month, even if he just sits in a darkened room and just keeps to himself.
Yeah.
For what he did to their business.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. I think that Hell in the Cell bump, just, I think that was really a pivotal thing for them to, I mean, they're already pretty successful by then, but I think that took it to another level.
Well, I think the Rock with the mat, or the match with the Rock, where he wins the title, is just one of those matches. Like, that is such a pivotal point in their business.
Mm.
Like, taking the lead from WCW and never giving it back. And he'd been building so much equity up with the fans up to that point. So,
yeah, brilliant guy. So, Rich, anything else you want to bring up?
No, I was funny. I've asked, like, when we first talked about this, I asked people of which ECW reunion they liked the most, and this got pretty high ratings.
Oh yeah.
Compared to the other ECW-ish reunions. Mm-hmm. So it's either this or 2005. And I would like to say to all the other ECW fans out there, let's just leave it on our videotapes. Let's let ECW be a great memory and not have to bring it back constantly.
Yes. Yeah, I will accept also the same with the NWO.
I'm just thinking of a retirement home now.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. And there's enough guys. There's probably about as many guys in ECW as were in NWO.
Yeah, it's close, you know. I believe I once counted there are 48 members of the NWO, so. Or 48 former members anyway, so.
Yeah. Well, it's for life, though, isn't it?
It is for life, so yeah, so, you know. I think most of them are alive. Like, well, Kurt Hennig and Rick Rude aren't around, but everyone else I think is pretty much still there. So
Macho Man.
Oh yeah, Macho Man. Yeah, well, there you go. So still a high percentage of them are still alive.
Much higher than ECW.
Well, actually, you know, most of the ECW guys have survived pretty well. Well, Rick Rude's also an ECW alum too, so.
Yeah, I don't remember Rick Rude in ECW, and it could have got by me, but yeah. No,
well, obviously Pillman and Spicoli. But yeah, ECW is a higher percentage of guys who survived than you might think. For whatever reason, even though they have, like, the most notorious locker room crazy stories ever, you know.
But it's one of those. They both, I guess Sabu and Scott Hall are in that same category then.
Right. So
guys that really should be dead by now.
And Jake Roberts too.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, hey, good for them.
Yes.
Good for them for being alive.
Oh, did you watch the Sabu Rey Mysterio match?
I feel like I've seen it a while ago, but I didn't watch it again.
it is like terrifying to watch the way that match ends. That's all I can say.
Yeah.
It's the things about like people not surviving. Like he almost kills Rey Mysterio.
Yeah.
Just hideous to see.
Right. And that was 6 years ago too. So
yeah,
that was. Sabu's still around. So yeah, Sabu's never really been one of my favorites. Just because of all the, you know, like just all the times that, you know, there were stuff that happens like, oh yeah, it's not, I mean, I get why he had that appeal. I get the character. I know, like, you know, like 94, she was considered one of the best in, you know, in the world. And he had that mystique and all that. I get why people liked him, but I just, for me, it never really has worked.
I guess it's one of the things that his match with Disco Inferno is one of the best lines of Sabu, where he's this guy who just totally, like, rules of wrestling, he just did not want them to apply to him.
Yes.
And because nothing bad happens, and Disco just terrifyingly runs out of that match in the middle, almost breaks out of the fourth wall there. Not let that happen.
Yeah.
So there, I can look back with that with a smile. Yeah. But yeah, a lot of Sabu stuff just is really hard to watch.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
So I have to, Taz Sabu is one of my favorite feuds of all time.
Yeah. I've seen, you know, the blow off, and I've seen some of the main angles, but it's been a while since I've seen any of that. I've been thinking of trying. I know on YouTube there's some ECW weekly TV episodes. I'm thinking of trying to like check out one per month or something, and kind of get a sense of better of, you know, just the shows and stuff. Because I didn't have ECW. Like, I wasn't really a big wrestling fan again until 97, and I didn't really get ECW in my area till 98, 99-ish, and I would watch it occasionally and, you know, follow it, and I certainly, you know, read up on it, and I was familiar with what was going on, but it's not quite the same as having lived it, and so I want to try to see if I can replicate that experience as best as I can and see if maybe there's just stuff that I've missed, the gaps that I've missed that would change of mind about ECW, which I, you know, the best stuff in ECW is great. I just feel like there's such a high percentage of stuff that's just kind of awful that, you know, that it, you know, for the perception that ECW has and the memories that it have, it just, like, I feel like a lot of rose-colored glasses, so to speak.
Well, it's, some of the stuff is harder to watch now, and so to really relive that, you're gonna have to wait till 2 a.m. You're going to have to go to the bar and close down the bar. And then you're going to have to come back to your place. And then while, like, trying to sober up a little bit before going to bed, that's when ECW TV was on in Philadelphia.
Right.
So there was a certain level of the appeal of that that had to do with guys being in their 20s and being, you know what I'm saying? Like, I watched it when I was in my 20s. And literally, I'd come in from the bar, sit down in the rec room, and watch an hour of ECW. And as many of those hours were horrible because they had no matches on them. They would have snippets of matches and tell you to buy the VHS tape.
Sure.
Like, a lot of those hardcore TVs were just infomercials.
Right.
But that was kind of a lot of broadcast wrestling at that time. That's what it was.
Mm-hmm.
That you just got a lot of infomercials. So I will admit, but there's times when, like, the pulp wrestling stuff was hilarious.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I'm referring to?
I've heard of it, but I've never seen it.
Just the little vignettes they'd cut. And they would have, like, 10 minutes of vignettes. And at times, it was just really funny.
Mm.
And that's when, watching ECW Unreleased, I kind of wish they had a roll of the pulp wrestling stuff. Like, for a whole month, Stevie Ray and the Blue Meanie were trying to get to the Kiss concert. So week after week, they'd be dressed like Kiss and trying to get someone to take them to a Kiss concert.
Mm-hmm.
And now, did I say Stevie Ray? No, that was, sorry.
That was Stevie Richards. Yes.
Yeah. Yes.
Stevie Ray. Now, Stevie Ray doing that would be pretty funny too, but
yeah, I just realized that. Yeah. Stevie Richards.
Yeah.
But those things were enjoyable.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I kind of made this illusion that ECW is kind of like punk music, in the way that punk music was as much a scene as it was recorded music.
Right.
So, And as many times as I remember in the late 80s, the hardcore scene, there were as many bad bands on the scene as good bands. Mm-hmm. But there was something like you'd still go to shows and you'd still – it was something that was counterculture, so you'd be happy to be there. And some of the, I really think a lot of the wrestling in ECW doesn't hold up because it was like this countercultural idea. Mm-hmm. And it was the first place in wrestling I'd seen anti-heroes. And it was the first place in wrestling where I'd seen really people manipulating the rules to be evil. And coming from watching WWE for such a long time, I just had never seen that before.
Yeah. Well, obviously ECW's influence, for what it's worth, is felt still across WWE storytelling and the wrestling world beyond that as well. So, you know, obviously they didn't win the battle, but to a certain extent, their ideas won the war.
Yeah, and you could say that there's more than a little of like Tommy Dreamer and Sandman combined to make up Stone Cold Steve Austin. Mm-hmm. So just that Stone Cold Steve Austin was probably twice as good of a performer than the two of them put together.
Maybe even more, but yes, I get what you're saying. Yeah.
That a little execution goes a long way in really turning out something to be good. Mm-hmm. So give someone, a great performer, the ability to do something. And even if it's someone else had the idea first, you can't hold them to that.
Sure. Sure. You know, as an aside, have you ever seen much of Dr. D, David Schultz?
No.
There's a YouTube clip of of Butcher Vachon's wedding from WWE. And okay. This has been roughly 84. And Dr. D sounds like almost exactly like Stone Cold Steve Austin. Like he does a promo that is eerily similar. It's crazy.
Wow.
Yeah. Highly recommend checking that out.
Yeah, I will definitely look for that.
Yeah, I believe David Shoemaker wrote about it in one of his recent Grantland columns. So. Okay. Yeah. So. Cool. All right, Rich. Well, of course, you are a co-host of the International Object podcast.
Yes, I am.
And, yeah.
Hope to get everyone to listen to that.
Yeah. We're
trying to drive our listeners a little bit higher.
Yeah. And of course, you can subscribe to that as you can subscribe to this show if you do the Fair to Flare master feed on iTunes and also internationalobject.com. And you're also on Twitter, of course.
Yes, I'm at EarthDog.
So so check out. Rich always has interesting thoughts about wrestling and has a fun I was going to say skewed. I don't mean that as an insult. I just mean your perspective is it's sober yet skewed perspective on professional wrestling and on many things, of course. So I enjoy interacting with you on Twitter and and appreciate you being on the show.
Well, thank you.
All right, everyone, of course, check out our sponsor again, RotoReels.com. You can check us out at WrestleSpective.com, where we have episodes and occasionally clips and fun things that go along with the podcast. And thanks again for listening, and we'll be back again soon.